2 years into his time as mayor and made Daley eligible for a pension worth 85% of his mayoral salary. That's better than any other city employee gets. And the Indiana Supreme Court should have a new Chief Justice in 2 weeks. The court announced Wednesday that the State Judicial Nominating Commission will meet May 15th to pick a new leader for the court from among the court's five justices. Brent Dixon has been the acting Chief Justice since Randall Shepard stepped down in March after heading the court for 25 years. The person selected by the seven-member commission will get a five-year term as Chief Justice. There's more news all the time at will.illinois.edu. I'm Craig Cohen, Illinois Public Media News.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to experience delicious specials, fair trade coffee, and your favorite treats at the Intermezzo Cafe. More information about upcoming events is at KrannertCenter.com.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Before we get into the forecast, I want to take just a minute or two and walk through some of the details from the National Weather Service's preliminary local storm report overnight dealing with yesterday's storms, the funnel clouds and in some cases EF1 tornado touchdowns across Illinois into Indiana. And the reason I want to just run through this is just to sort of reinforce how even this lowest level form of a tornado, an EF1, can really do some serious damage. First of all, there were a lot of funnel cloud and tornado brief touchdowns here and there through Monticello, into Savoy, into Champaign and Danville. I'm just going to share some of them that did some damage. One of the moments where there was a brief touchdown was in, 4 miles southwest of Savoy. Windows were shattered on the south side of a house. Shingles removed. Part of the roof was removed. Extensive tree damage. One 8-inch diameter tree was uprooted and thrown 50 yards. That word from the Seymour Fire Department. The tornado then touched down on the ground for about 7 minutes in Champaign, a brief touchdown on the west side of Sydney. Once it reached Tilton, this would have been about 5:18 yesterday, late afternoon. There in Vermilion, or rather in Tilton, a metal garage port was thrown about 70 yards. Then as the storm advanced into Indiana, the National Weather Service confirmed that the tornado destroyed a barn and damaged nearby homes in a rural part of western Indiana. Again, this was an EF1 tornado, and it was on the ground for about half a mile near the Montgomery County town of New Ross. No reports of injuries from the storm, but once again, this sort of reinforces how a major storm like this, as it rolls through, even if it's just EF1 on that expanded Fujita scale, even if it's at that lowest level, can really do some damage. And so just wanted to reinforce that. So the next time you hear us interrupting All Things Considered or any other programs with lots of weather alerts, you understand why, because of the seriousness of the situation. All right, that said, overnight, a warm front pushed north of the area, allowing southwest winds to develop and spread a summer-like air mass across the region. No doubt you've noticed that for the middle and end of this week. Most of the thunderstorm activity for the next couple of days should be associated with a frontal boundary, which will stall out across Iowa, northern Illinois, and Wisconsin. Rain chances should increase across central Illinois towards the end of the week into the weekend as the front slowly sags to the south. Low temperatures this morning range from the middle 50s in northern Wisconsin to the upper 60s across western Kentucky. High temperatures today should range from the mid 70s in northern Wisconsin to the upper 80s in southeast Missouri and western Kentucky. And here in Champaign-Urbana today, we're expecting partly sunny and breezy conditions the rest of the day with a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high around 85, and we're kind of almost closing in on it. We're at 77 right now. Winds out of the southwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour, but gusts to up around 30 miles per hour. In fact, at Willard Airport, they were reporting wind gusts of about 29 miles an hour at the top of the hour. Partly cloudy tonight with a low around 65. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high around 87. Thursday night, mostly cloudy. Occasional gusty winds. A slight chance for showers and thunderstorms with the low again around 65. And as I mentioned, there's a chance for more showers and thunderstorms in the forecast, and that'll continue Friday through Monday night. Highs through the weekend in the low to mid 80s. Lows in the upper 50s to mid 60s. At Danville, it's 80 degrees, 80 as well in Decatur, and Rockford, there are overcast skies, 70 degrees. I mentioned over at Willard Airport that they were reporting some wind gusts in excess of 29 miles per hour. Well, they're mostly cloudy conditions there. It was 81 degrees at the top of the hour. On Friends Plaza, outside our studios, it's 77 degrees. at 12:41. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Pharmaceutical company Pfizer has agreed to settle a lawsuit brought by Brigham Young University over the creation of the prescription pain reliever Celebrex. A jury trial had been scheduled to start later this month. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has this report.
Celebrex is one of the most successful commercial drugs ever, and Brigham Young University claimed that it was entitled to more than $9 billion in royalties. The university said that's because one of its professors, Daniel Simmons, helped create Celebrex. Pfizer maintains the terms of the research agreement with the scientist had been complied with. Pfizer revealed the $450 million settlement amount in a routine regulatory filing.
I would characterize it as a sizable settlement.
But University of Kansas law professor Andrew Torrance says the number doesn't look quite so big when you consider that Celebrex has generated revenues of roughly $35 billion. Torrance says he wasn't surprised that Pfizer settled the case.
I have a suspicion that in front of a jury, a lone individual, a scientist, who everybody acknowledges had some early science leading up to the drug, was up against a gigantic company which had made $35 billion. I wouldn't want to be in the company's shoes against this lone, heroic inventor.
Detailed terms of the settlement have not been made public, but Brigham Young University says it was very, very pleased with how the matter had been resolved. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Chicago has dug in its heels on a new city ordinance that puts banks on the line for securing and maintaining vacant homes. But the federal government, on behalf of mortgage backers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is fighting it in a test case that could affect other cities, too. Odette Youssef of member station WBEZ in Chicago reports.
Chicago's old rules put the burden of securing and maintaining vacant homes solely on the shoulders of their owners. But a big increase of foreclosures has highlighted the limits of that approach. In Chicago, thousands of homes have been abandoned, and their owners have disappeared. So when the homes became dangerous or fell into disrepair, Judy Friedland, an attorney for Chicago, says the city picked up the slack.
We can't leave the property vacant and open, so that meant the city had to secure it. So the taxpayers were paying to secure the building, in essence.
And it's not cheap. One estimate puts the cost to Chicago taxpayers at $36 million in 2010 alone. And Friedland says that's just not fair.
The city wasn't a part of this transaction. We weren't part of that mortgage. The owner and the lender made an agreement. So why should the taxpayers be the one to come in and have to pay for an agreement that went south?
So in November, Chicago started making lenders responsible too. Now, if an owner is up to 45 days delinquent on the mortgage, the lender has to check if the home's been abandoned. If it has, the lender then has to secure it and register it with the city for a $500 fee. After that, the lender has to keep it up to city code or risk hefty daily fines. But Richard Gottlieb says this is now creating more problems.
How does one know that property is vacant?
Gottlieb directs the financial industry group for the law firm Dykema. He says the cities that have enacted similar ordinances are putting lenders in an impossible position.
Lawsuits are being brought by the dozen by borrowers claiming that their property wasn't really abandoned and that the lender or servicer went in without permission. And judges all throughout are looking at those cases very seriously because that is a trespass.
That's also part of what the federal government argues in a lawsuit challenging Chicago's new rules. The Federal Housing Finance Agency sued on behalf of the two lenders that it regulates, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which own more than 250,000 mortgages in Chicago alone. For now, they're complying with the city's ordinance, but they say Chicago unfairly makes them act like an owner before the property is legally theirs. They also argue that Congress made the FHFA their sole regulator, so they shouldn't have to answer to the city of Chicago. While what happens here could affect cities across the country, for Ruben DeSantiago, this is a very local issue. DeSantiago lives on Chicago's south side, and when he saw me and a community organizer checking out a vacant home on his block, he hurried over to us.
I live across the street, and there's a lot of gang activity in this house.
Right.
I mean, I called the police a couple of times, and there's kids that go in, they go out. There's a guy that parks trucks on the back, and I got kids, so...
Yeah, we're trying to figure it out.
For now, DeSantiago and his neighbors mow the lawn and pick up trash here. But he says somebody needs to be held responsible for this house. This lawsuit may determine whether that will be lenders when owners disappear. For NPR News, I'm Odette Youssef.
This weekend is the Kentucky Derby, and all eyes will be on the three-year-old champion colt, Hanson. Commentator Frank DeFord says while Hanson is not a favorite, his white coloring ensures he will be the center of attention.
The champion colt named Hanson will not be the favorite in the Derby Saturday, but most eyes will unavoidably be upon him. You see, in a field of chestnuts and bays, Hanson is already brilliant white. Well, technically he's a gray, but without boring you with equine pigmentation detail, thoroughbred grays, like the great native dancer, turn whiter as they grow older. And Hanson is simply prematurely white, sort of a four-legged Steve Martin. But as rare as white horses are, less than 8%, it is amazing how they've fascinated virtually every culture. White horses are chosen to stand for good and for bad. One of the four horsemen of the apocalypse rides a pale horse, but the unicorn, which is invariably depicted as white, stands for purity. Only virgins can capture unicorns. But contrariwise, in some cultures, white horses represent fertility. But white horses stand for power and glory, too. In the book of Revelation, not only Jesus, but all the armies of heaven will descend astride white horses. In politics, the man on the white horse invariably refers to the leader who's going to save us. When Peel and Trumbull famously painted George Washington with a horse, the father of our country's steed is white. For the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee's famous mount Traveler really was a white horse. White horses are just as common in fiction. Pegasus is a white horse. So is the little white pony doll. And in Shrek, the donkey turns into a white horse. Even in nursery rhyme, ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross to see a fine lady upon a white horse. And currently in rock, Taylor Swift sings, it's too late for you and your white horse to catch me now. Even though nobody but the infamous Peeping Tom is supposed to have seen Lady Godiva ride in the buff through the streets of Coventry, she's invariably portrayed astride a white steed. And, of course, after Dusty, his noble chestnut, was killed by bad guys, the Lone Ranger found a new mount.
I'll Silver!
It's amazing. For being such a small minority in the animal world, nobody pops up in so many cultures, in so many places, representing so many different things, good and bad, as do white horses. However, in the 137 Kentucky Derbies, seven gray colts have won, and winning colors, a roan with a white face, was a filly who beat the boys in 1988, but no horse so pale as ivory as Hanson has ever won. Hanson likes to go to the front, and as they turn for home Saturday, will he still be there on top? Here they come now, down the stretch. But instead of my old Kentucky home, this year maybe...
A little Lone Ranger action at the end there. The comments of Frank DeFord. You can hear him every Wednesday on Morning Edition right here on WILL AM 580.
The long-term future of public media in Central Illinois depends on the generosity of people like you who can make special gifts through their estate. Consider including WILL in your estate plan. Leave your own legacy and support what you love. Your attorney can help you put your wishes into proper form. For information on the WILL Legacy Circle, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 2nd of May, 2012. It was on this date, 1536, Anne Boleyn, the second wife of King Henry VIII, was arrested for high treason, adultery, and incest. She was intelligent, outspoken. She'd been raised in France. She had educated opinions about politics and religious reform. She came to the court when she was 20 years old to serve as a lady-in-waiting. She soon caught the eye of the king, and for 7 years he courted her, and for 7 years she put him off. He managed to get his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled by breaking with the Pope, declaring himself head of the Church of England. And then Anne Boleyn consented to marry him. Their early months of marriage were happy ones. Their first child, a girl born in 1533, Elizabeth. Anne had several miscarriages after that, and she never gave Henry the son that he so desperately wanted. So he accused her of every capital offense he could think of, affairs and incest with her brother and plotting his murder and witchcraft, and she was convicted and sentenced to death, beheaded by sword. In her last letter to Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn wrote, "Your Grace's displeasure and my imprisonment are things so strange to me that what to write I am altogether ignorant. Never a prince had a wife more